Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, where we are reminded over and over again that freedom isn't free. Each time we visit with World War II veterans, the idea to honor them for their service, their sacrifice, to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten, so we don't forget how great a price has been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we're always educated, often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. These guys don't want to be called heroes, but it has become crystal clear to me that no matter where your hometown is in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small it might be, those heroes are there, next door, around the corner, down the street. And unless we ask, we have no idea what kind of things they've endured on our behalf. Usually I visit the veterans in their homes to ask those kinds of questions, but this week's show's a little different. Interviewing a veteran a week for the last 8 years, I've had the privilege of meeting some pretty incredible people. And I've come across some veterans organizations whose commitment and dedication are impossible to miss. The Wahoo base of U.S. submarine veterans definitely fits that description. And these fine submariners from Central California invited me to tag along on a bus ride to San Francisco last weekend. That will be the setting for the show today. We're going to hear from a Modesto man who served on a submarine during World War II and squeezed his 89-year-old body through those tiny hatches again last weekend. He was able to do that because Pier 45 at San Francisco's Fisherman's Wharf is home to a couple other World War II veterans we'll be discussing today. They can't speak, but boy, do they have some stories. And they give you a chance to experience World War II history on a daily basis. I'm talking about the Liberty Ship, SS Jeremiah O'Brien, and the Baleo-class submarine USS Pampanito, part of the San Francisco Maritime National Historic Park. We've heard from a fair number of submariners over the years on Hometown Heroes, but I got to tell you, it adds a whole new dimension to the stories they've shared when you step into the cramped quarters of a World War II submarine for yourself and imagine being in that spot as some of those tense moments we've heard about unfolded. Thanks to Ted Dick, Robert Houck, and the rest of my friends from the Wahoo base, I had that opportunity last week, and I hope you get to experience it sometime too. That particular boat, don't call it a ship to a submariner, it's a boat, the Pampanito had some interesting chapters in the impressive record of submarines in World War II. Did you know that even though submarine personnel made up less than 2% of our armed forces in World War II, submarines were responsible for 55% of all the enemy shipping destroyed. That's pretty impressive, but it was also very risky and proved very costly. These numbers illustrate that. 52 submarines, one out of every five subs that made patrols in World War II, 52 submarines were lost. On those 52 subs, more than 3,500 men died. That's one out of every seven submariners. And those men all volunteered for submarine duty. Visit the Pampanito in San Francisco, and you'll be walking, and if you're 6'3 like I am, ducking on a boat that made six patrols during World War II. The Pampanito sank six Japanese ships and damaged four others. You can examine the torpedo tubes that made all that possible and learn the story of how the Pampanito and two other subs attacked a Japanese convoy in September 1944, only to learn afterwards that there were over 2,000 British and Australian prisoners of war on those Japanese ships. The Pampanito returned to the area and was able to rescue 73 of those POWs, and you can actually watch online footage from that rescue shot through periscope cameras back in 1944. The Pampanito is preserved as it was when the war ended in 1945, and it's kept in terrific shape by a great crew of volunteers. The day I was there, I encountered visitors from several different countries climbing down into the Pampanito, but I don't think any of them could experience it the way the man we're about to hear from did. Harold Molnix, originally from Colorado, but a longtime resident of Modesto, California, where his friends and neighbors know him simply as Hal. Hal is a submarine veteran of World War II. He toured the Pampanito with other submariners from the Wahoo base, and when he was done, I sat down next to him on a bench in the middle of Fisherman's Wharf to get a little of his story. If you hear a little background noise at some point, that location might explain it. Let's hear from 89-year-old Hal Molnix. Well, let's go way, way back, more than 70 years back. What do you remember growing up in Colorado? You were there in Aurora, just outside of Denver. What was life like?
Life was a very small town, nothing exciting, no school buses. Most of the time they had to walk. There was very little problem as far as people are concerned. It was just a very nice small community in Aurora.
You had been in high school when December 7th, 1941 rolled around. I like to ask every veteran about that because everybody seems to remember something. What do you remember about that day and how you found out that Pearl Harbor had been attacked?
Well, that day I was going across the viaduct in downtown Denver. Another friend of I and myself and two girls were on the way to a movie when we heard it on the radio, and so we turned around and went back home again. And was, you know, very, very surprised and very concerned, you know, about whatever was happening. So it was just a complete surprise with us and everybody else. So that's what we were doing on that particular day.
And did you have any inkling at that point that you were going to somehow become part of this war that was starting?
Aurora didn't have its own paper, so it was the Denver Post, and I don't remember anything that would indicate that there was going to be that kind of a problem. No, I just never thought anything would be like that at all.
But before long, you would be involved, and you told me you'd had a fascination or an interest in the Navy for some time?
Yes, I did. I had a cousin who was career Navy, and he'd come and visit us once in a while, and through him and talking to him and things, you know, that went on, I became very interested in the Navy. So when the war broke out and I wanted to go into the service, so I went down to the volunteer in Denver, and they said since I was so close to graduation, which would be the following May, that they had me wait until I graduated, and then I went right into the Navy from then.
You were so willing to go and ready that you tried to not even finish high school.
Well, I actually did graduate May the 30th, and I was in boot camp in June the 10th in San Diego. I volunteered for 6 years. That may have been one reason why I was accepted in the submarine service, because I volunteered for submarines when I was still in boot camp. So after all the testing and everything, they sent me right to electrical school in St. Louis.
Why did you volunteer for submarines? Because I think people today have an idea of submarines that is quite different from what it was in World War II. I mean, this is pretty unproven stuff, pretty risky stuff. What about the submarine service at that point made you say, yeah, I want to do that?
Well, I don't know whether it was that or whether I was figuring out maybe if I went submarines, I might not get seasick if I went to sea. I don't really remember why, but submarines had really interested me from talking to my cousin who was in the Navy. And so I just thought maybe I could get into that. So that's why I volunteered.
Of all the training that you had to go through to prepare for what you eventually did, what do you remember being the toughest element of that?
I had lots of schooling on going to electrical school. And then when I went to submarine school in New London, Connecticut, maybe the hardest thing that I thought was going to be was going up through the tower and the escape through there. I made the 100-foot ascent, I think, was probably the second try. So at first I thought that was going to be really tough, but fortunately it didn't seem to be for me. I don't know.
You never had to do that for real, right?
No. No problems with that. And even on our war patrols, we never, I didn't feel we were in serious trouble. The last patrol probably was the closest we came to that, when we were under attack for probably about 12 hours. And we had, according to the captain's log, we had 189 attempts to sink us with the escorts that were following the convoy. And then when they used all their depth charges, then they'd go back to fill up with, and they'd aircraft from the Japan would come out. So according to the captain's log, between the aerial bombs and depth charges, they made 189 attempts to sink us. So that was probably the hairiest time that I can remember.
Yeah, and I want to come back to that, but You're talking about the USS Sturgeon, a Salmon-class submarine, and I want to get your impressions of that boat. Not a ship. You're talking to a submariner. It's a boat. And it had a pretty good story from the start of the war. It was actually out at sea during Pearl Harbor and came up with a clever encapsulation of its early action, I hear.
She was at the dock in Pearl, not in Pearl Harbor, in the Philippine Islands when the war broke out. So she went right to sea when the war was declared. I wasn't on her, but when she sunk her first ship, she sent back a message to Comm Subpack that the Virgin Sturgeon was no longer a virgin. So that's, I understand that also appeared with some kind of a report after during the war or something like that. It was reported to the public so that they knew that this was what happened.
And you came aboard the Sturgeon in October of 1943, right?
I'd finished submarine school and was transferred to San Francisco. The Sturgeon was coming out of dry dock at Hunters Point, San Francisco. And I had been assigned to the boat. That's where I first went aboard her.
Was there any kind of indoctrination or anything that you had to do to get in the good graces of the sailors who had been on there for a while?
Not really that I can remember. I didn't feel that I was, tested or anything like that. All the guys that I met, right at the beginning of the boat tour was real good buddies. I did have a problem with the chief electrician on the boat. He and I didn't get along very well, so every chance he got, he put me to mess cooking. And when we went to sea on our first patrol, one of the cooks had a real problem with slicing his hand with when he was doing some in the galley. And I'd gotten real well acquainted with all the guys there, so anyway, they said if I'd help him with a watch in the galley, that they'd help me and get me a rate when I came out. So that's what I did, and that's why I went from electrician striker to a ship's cook.
What about the camaraderie on the boat at the USS Pampanito here that you've just toured with the rest of the guys from the Wahoo base? There's a big picture outside the boat that says 80 men, 75 days, no showers. What was life like on that World War II submarine?
They pretty well described that. Most of our boats things weren't quite that long, but yeah, we could get freshwater showers at the very beginning, but then once we got to sea and been in sea for quite some time, it was saltwater showers. And not too often, but other than that, it was great, and all the guys put up with everybody else, so I don't remember there being a real problem as far as the guys are concerned with each other.
Today's submarines can stay submerged for weeks and months on end, but in World War II with those diesel subs, you would have to surface on a daily basis. How often did you guys actually dive, and were those nerve-wracking moments? What did it feel like to know you were going under, and there was probably a reason for that?
I don't remember feeling any real problems with that. Yeah, we did have daily dives so that we could charge the batteries and take care of other things. But I don't remember anybody on the boat that ever expressed real fear or anything like that when we made our dives. And I don't remember myself feeling any fear.
When you look back now and you see the statistics about the percentage of submariners who died during World War II, do you look back and say, maybe I should have been more concerned for myself?
Well, I never really thought about it. And my problem was that when I got out of the Navy, I was completely away from that for several years. And in fact, I probably was about 10 or 15 years after I'd been out of the Navy that I even found out that the submarines sailors had a retired group, and the meetings and so forth. All of that things that were maybe in my mind when I left the Navy was pretty much behind that, because I didn't talk to any sailors, I didn't talk to anybody like that. So a lot of the things that happened aboard the boat I really don't remember a lot of.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And we're thankful you're sharing the things you do remember with us today, giving us a taste of life aboard a submarine in World War II. More with Mr. Molnix when we come back. And before we're done, we're going to hear about another impressive example of history preserved at San Francisco's Pier 45, the Liberty ship Jeremiah O'Brien. This weekend is actually what they call a steaming weekend. You can actually see the O'Brien steam-powered engine in action. Boy, is that impressive. If you watch the movie Titanic, you've already seen the engine room. We'll hear all about it before we're done. You know, the Jeremiah O'Brien was at Normandy on D-Day. And in a moment, I'm going to tell you how you can help a Central California group participate in the 70th anniversary of D-Day next June. Hometown Heroes will be right back at you after this. Central California has plenty of talented musicians. That's not news. But this is. 45 musicians from the area are hoping to head to Normandy next June to take part in the 70th anniversary commemoration of the D-Day landings. They'll represent the Clovis Community Band. Clovis Mayor Lynn Ashbeck will go along, and the Clovis Veterans Memorial District has given them a great head start on their fundraising goal. I've got the perfect way for you to help, too. All you have to do is eat some delicious food catered by Pardini's, enjoy some outstanding music that Joe Lennigan Band will perform. You can dance to your heart's content, and there are some pretty impressive auction items you might want to bid on, too. It's the Night to Remember Dinner Dance, Saturday night, August 17th in Clovis, and all the proceeds will help make these dedicated local musicians a special part of D-Day's 70th anniversary. To reserve your tickets for the dinner dance, call 559-431-3160. That's 559-431-3160. And go online to find out more about this sentimental journey by visiting ClovisCommunityBandDday.org.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Lafler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an interview recorded at Pier 45 in San Francisco. If you go there this weekend, you can catch the SS Jeremiah O'Brien and all of its glorious steam power. It's a steaming weekend, and they'll light that puppy up. We're going to hear about that a little later on, but we continue now with 89-year-old Hal Molnix of Modesto, California, originally from Aurora, Colorado. And during World War II, he was a cook aboard the USS Sturgeon, a salmon-class submarine. If you hear a little noise or the occasional seagull in the background, that's because we talked right out in the open in Fisherman's Wharf right after he had toured the USS Pompanito. If you tour that museum boat, you'll see how big, or maybe I should say how small, that submarine galley is. And what about the selection? What did you have to work with as a cook to try to keep these hungry submariners satisfied?
At the beginning of most of the patrols, we were really in good shape, but towards the end of some of the patrols, we had to improvise with special canned foods, and if there were any meat that we had to take aboard when we started the patrol, we were trimming maybe half to three quarters of an inch of the meat off, say, like a big piece of beef or something, because it had dried up, molded enough, you know, to where you had to trim it down to where you could get rid of it. So that, and by the time the end of the patrols were, we were improvising on what we had left of food. Most of it was canned type of food. There was very little fresh food and fresh vegetables or anything like that that we had when we were on the patrol. And that depended on, of course, on the length of the patrol also, because some of the patrols were pretty long.
How did you deal with complaints from the crew about what you were putting on that plate?
You know, I don't really remember that as such, but the guys knew that whatever they were eating, the cooks were eating also. So I really didn't have a problem. And the officers were always the same way. They ate whatever we had. And I don't remember any complaints really from the crew at all, the officers or men. But then, like I say, it's been a long time since I thought about this. But
what if general quarters sounded? I imagine the galley was not your duty station.
Depended on that. It was, if I was on watch on the galley, I stayed there, and others took the other one. But if I was not on watch, then my duty station, if we were submerged, would be on the bow planes. No matter where I was on the boat, that's where I would go. Yeah, because there was, you know, different things you were doing. If you were on, like you were on watch in the galley, well, that's where you stayed to take care of things, and someone else would have that the duty station to go to and take the bow or stern planes.
Did it take you some time to adjust to sleeping on a submarine, or was that something that just came naturally?
You know, I don't remember having a problem to sleep when I was not on watch. I read a lot. I'd rig a lamp in my bunk and hang my blanket or something so it would close off the light for the other guys that need to be sleeping, and I'd read a lot sometimes in the bunk and then go to sleep. So I don't remember having a problem sleeping.
You just went on a World War II submarine again today, Pier 45 in San Francisco. How much different did it feel, and was it a little harder to move around on a submarine at age 89 compared to age 19?
Well, at age 19, I went just slipped them right through there, but today I had to work my way through there and get my, sometimes my legs would have a little trouble getting through the hatch, but after two or three, I kind of remembered what I was supposed to be doing, so it was better.
What was that like to be back on a World War II submarine 70 years after you were doing it for real?
Well, it was kind of nice to get back and see what it was like, but the configuration in the compartments seemed to be quite a bit different than what I remember on the Sturgeon. But then the Pomponito is a newer boat, and there may have been other things that were in the boat or arranged differently. So I felt like I was I wasn't claustrophobic, but it felt like there was more crowded within the different compartments than what I remembered when I was aboard the Sturgeon.
And you mentioned the patrols the Sturgeon made while you were aboard. What can you tell us about those? Where were you, and what was it that you guys were supposed to be doing?
Well, it was a search and destroy. We didn't have any special assignments like sending troops or somebody on board onto an island where they were doing something special. But we did pick up three flyers toward the end of the war when these flyers were doing bombing raids over Japan, and they'd get shot down. The targets by that time were getting few and far between, so the boats also were put in picket duty that would be in certain areas where the pilots might be expected to be in that general area. So that's once they would get the information why they would pick them up. So we picked up three pilots on the last patrol that we were on, but that was prior to board. We went to the just off of Tokyo Bay, and that's where we sunk the ships that were coming out of bay as a convoy, and that's when they made the 189 attempts to sink us.
Paint a picture for us if you can. Help us understand what that would have been like on the ship, on the boat, I should say, when you guys sunk an enemy ship. Is this something that an announcement is made, word spreads, everyone gets excited, or how would that play out aboard the boat?
I don't think there was excitement so much as, I don't know, maybe just the confidence or whatever that we did manage to sink a target, and that was just one less that they had to worry about. A lot of times we would get in an area, though, after sinking a ship that we'd have to run silent, so everything that would possibly generate sound would be turned off, like the fans in the compartments, and like in the galley we had to be very careful, and if we were going to have anything that we had to sit down to make any noise or something, we had to either just take care of it or hold it or put it down and very softly so that it wouldn't echo and go to the people who were searching for us. But I honestly don't remember anybody being happy that we've sunk somebody.
Well, you said earlier that you don't remember feeling fear, but when you're running silent like that and you can't even clank a fork on a plate in the galley, how can you not be afraid? I think, you know, that would scare the torpedoes out of me.
Well, yeah, I probably was afraid, and I probably had fear, but like I say, I've been away from that for so long, and my memory is really not all that great with a lot of things anymore, so I can't say I wasn't afraid. I just don't remember being afraid.
Was that for any particular reason? Were you just young and fearless? Was it because of confidence you had in your crewmates? Was it faith? How would you size up that fearlessness or confidence that you had?
Well, I think probably it was an idea that we were all in the same boat, and if I was going to get it, then the other guys were going to too. But as to displaying any kind of fear, I really don't remember anybody on the boat that I can remember that actually expressed or seemed to display fear. And I don't know whether it's the fact that we made different patrols and different approaches, and nothing major happened to the boat.
Do you remember how you found out that Japan had surrendered?
Well, actually, by that time, I was back in San Francisco. The last patrol that we had, and with the boat, was damaged so badly, and the 189 attempts, we went back to Pearl Harbor, and they inspected the Sturgeon and decided that she would not fit for another patrol.
So this was your last patrol, and you made mention of this. There were 189 attempts to sink you, whether from the air or from ships at sea. And you didn't notice at the time, but so then you get back into Pearl Harbor, they examine the ship and are basically saying, how'd you guys make it back?
Yeah, we don't get that conversation from anybody, but that's what it was. And so they stripped the Sturgeon down to a skeleton crew. Quite a few of us went then on sub base at Pearl Harbor, and the Sturgeon went back to the States. I was at sub base at Pearl Harbor for about 6 months, until I got signed to shore duty in Treasure Island first, and then up at the General Court Martial Brig up on YBI. So I was actually on shore duty in San Francisco area when Japan surrendered.
Well, I would imagine being in San Francisco on that day was probably a pretty interesting place to be. And here you are in San Francisco again today. Was there a little celebration in San Francisco with that news?
Oh, yes. In fact, my wife and I were downtown on Market Street to get a blood draw for we were going to get married. And that was the day that Japan surrendered. And of course, you know what San Francisco was like that day. It was just a madhouse. And so they closed up on us, so we had to go back at a later date. So we just went back to her folks' house and spent the rest of the day. So yeah, but Market Street was crazy when it finally was declared the war was over.
And did that give you a sense of satisfaction or pride, knowing that you'd been a part of this really worldwide effort?
I don't know. I don't feel like I don't remember celebrating. I was pleased. I was glad that it was over with.
When I'm bouncing around a little bit here, but when you got to that sub base at Pearl Harbor and you heard that news about the ship being too damaged to go back out for another war patrol, did that get your attention at all? Did that make you feel fortunate to have come through it so cleanly?
You know, I really don't remember the feelings.
Let me approach that a different way then. How many kids and grandkids and great-grandkids you have?
I have 3 great-grandkids living in the same town that I do in Modesto, and I have 7 grandkids now living in Southern California.
You've got 3 generations after you of your family that wouldn't be here if the Japanese had been a little more successful in trying to sink your submarine. Does that make you feel like someone was looking out for you, or you were fortunate?
Oh, yes, I am. I feel very fortunate, and I think we had some good skippers that took good care of us and good crews, and yeah, I think we were fortunate for us to get through, considering the mighty boats that were lost.
Yeah, and when you think about that, when you walk up to the Pampanito here and you see the memorial to the 52 submarines that sank during World War II, what kind of emotions does that bring up in you? What does that make you think?
Well, it makes me feel, you know, sad about all of the guys that were lost. But, of course, at each meeting, we told the boats for the boats that were lost for that particular month. And the major meetings, we told the boats for all of the boats that were lost, including the boats then that were lost prior to the war and after the war. So the tolling of the boats is a very solemn thing for all the submarine sailors.
Do you ever look at that and think, you know, that could have been me?
Oh, not consciously, I don't think I do, but probably subconscious. Yeah, I think, yeah, that's very fortunate that I survived.
What do you get out of spending time with other submariners, whether they're your age or from the Cold War, Vietnam era? What do you get out of those interactions?
Just the camaraderie of being together and being through the same kinds of things, and knowing that we're each one that we're, you know, in war years, we're very fortunate to return back. I guess it's a bond that's kind of forged during that time that just never ends.
When you think back on World War II, other than simply surviving it, what are you most proud of? What are you most thankful for?
Well, I'm most proudful, and I think about it as the wonderful, the way that the United States responded, not just servicemen, but individuals that were left at home, and how they ever jumped in and just did everything that could possibly be done, and things that just went on. And it was a United States-wide effort that made us respond to the things that we did and the way we responded to come out at the end of the war. So that's the United States that we have, it, you know, that has there today.
Well, I just want to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling me a little bit about it. Is there anything else that I didn't ask you about you think we ought to know?
I can't think of anything. Thank you. I appreciate you talking to me.
As always, the pleasure is all mine. That's Hal Molnix of Modesto, California. You can see what he looks like by following Hometown Heroes Radio on Facebook. And we're not done yet. From a submersible boat to a hastily built Liberty ship that is still fully functional. We'll learn about some more World War II history you can go touch and feel in San Francisco right after this. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there, free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkernCounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, CVHonorFlight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I'm hoping the submarine veterans from the Fresno area Wahoo base will take another bus tour to San Francisco so maybe you can experience what I did last week. You've heard about the USS Pampanito, the museum submarine there at Pier 45, and we've heard a little bit about what one World War II submariner, Hal Molnix, experienced. But if you keep walking past the sub to the end of that pier, you'll find a big steam-powered Liberty ship that has a pretty good World War II story of its own. It's the SS Jeremiah O'Brien, and I got the grand tour from one of the O'Brien's many volunteers, Mike Savino. And Mike, this is pretty unique. This is a ship that took supplies to Normandy and was there on D-Day. And not only is so much of the ship authentically preserved, just as it was in 1945, it's still fully operational.
That's probably the best thing about it, that it is operational. Everything just sits there, you know, the aircraft carriers, the sub, and this is a 1943 Liberty ship. We still do 4 or 5 trips a year. The public can pay to come on. We go out for the day around the bay, out past the Golden Gate. It takes quite a few people to run the ship, and you have to have engineers. We have a deck department, an engine crew, engine department, and so it takes quite a few departments to keep it going.
What all do you personally do on the ship?
I'm with the engineering department, and the engineering department, besides running the ship when it's underway in the engine room, is in charge of repairs on the ship, all repairs, piping, welding problems, anything like that. The deck department runs the winches and does painting and pretty much on the deck. Engine room does all the repairs and everything, and that includes electricians.
And when you've got a ship that's 70 years old, I imagine the repairs are never ending.
They're only made to last 5 years. And if they got one trip out of them full of cargo, they actually paid for themselves one trip. But they never expected them to last more than 5 years, and of course they did. And then they lasted after the war. Onassis bought a lot of them. That's how he got his business going. Aristotle Onassis bought a lot of Liberty ships. And then they were used up until the Vietnam War. You know, a lot of other countries bought them after the war too. So they got spread around, but they're all pretty much worn out. And to my knowledge, this is the only original cargo Liberty ship left. And there's one in Baltimore that was converted to a troop carrier.
And this ship was there on June 6, 1944, delivering cargo to Normandy.
Yes, it was. It made actually 11 different trips back and forth, but it was there. Very lucky ship, been through a lot and survived with hardly a scratch on it. So it was one of the lucky ones.
Yeah, and you've just taken me all over the ship. We saw the engine room, and you explained how all the different steam boilers work together. Steam power throughout this ship, and people my age and younger really don't know what steam power is. How often do you have to explain to some of the people that come through and ask you questions how this ship actually works? Because it's something we're not really used to today.
That's true. Unless somebody comes through that actually knows about it, they're not familiar at all with steam. And this is what we call a low-pressure steamship. It doesn't use turbines or anything. But we use steam for everything. The main engine uses steam. All the deck winches use steam. The coffee urn has a steam coil in it. the rooms are all heated by radiators. So everything, that's why it was such a simplistic ship to make. Just the one engine. Steam would run everything. There's really no electric motors on the ship per se. Everything you wanted to run, you would open up a steam box. And that would start either a blower or a pump working, and steam takes pretty much takes over.
You're one of a couple hundred volunteers in a core group that's smaller than that, that's here consistently, time after time after time. Why is it so important to keep this ship here, keep it operational, maintain what it is? What's so special about what the O'Brien represents?
Well, for me, and I've never been in the military, I love working on this ship. I feel like I'm giving something back, especially for all the men that did what they did during the wars. But since it is one of the only ships around, and it's all volunteer and all privately funded, nothing from the government or anything, and it's the last one left in the world, and it still functions, which is what's really great, because people don't get to see this. You can see a static museum-type thing, but it's different when things are running, you know. And besides the trips we do these steaming weekends where we'll actually start the ship up dockside here, and it runs at a slow speed, but the engine will be running, the propeller will be turning, and they can see everything functioning with all the work crews and everything. But you can see by going around the ship how much the guys love it. Nobody's forcing anybody to come here, but here they are on their Saturday, and they've all got their different projects, whether they're working on gun tubs or replacing rust parts or whatever they're doing. You know, everybody loves coming here. And I have to say, though, it is a dwindling crew as far as the gentlemen from the war. You know, a lot of those guys just aren't here anymore, and they were the backbone, so we have to learn what we can learn while they're still here.
What was it that got you hooked? How did you start volunteering here? It's been, what, you said 9 years ago now?
Well, my background is mechanical. I do refrigeration and mechanical work. So when I came aboard here, you know, I was just impressed with the ship. And then I saw a little sign that said you can be a volunteer. And I actually couldn't believe that you could actually get to work on this ship and be a volunteer. So I signed up that same day. And that's basically history. As soon as I signed up, I've been coming all the time. I'm pretty involved in a lot of projects with the engine department. You know, I meet with a lot of people that want to donate equipment. And we get a lot of retired guys, early retired guys. And it's hard to get volunteers because everybody works. I'm self-employed, so I make time to come every Thursday. That's just my slot. Some people like the golf. My thing is to ship, so I come on Thursdays. That's my day to come. You know, we have showers and food and everything you need here. Sometimes there's only one person on the ship. Sometimes there's none. And, you know, sometimes toward a steaming weekend, it'll be full for 3, 4, 5 days. But people come in from all over, Santa Rosa, from the valley, depending where they're from. So they get to stay aboard here.
From Sonora?
And Sonora, too, where I'm from.
Yeah, you live in Sonora. That's not an easy drive into the city. Is it just because you get to sleep on the ship and you look out, you see the Golden Gate on one end, Coit Tower on the other, and all the scenery, the Alcatraz across the bay? Is that what sucks you in, or is there something greater that you get out of this?
Well, for me, to be honest, it's a twofold thing. My business is here, so when I'm down from Sonora, I stay on the ship at night and I do my regular business during the day. It's just great to be here and do that and be able to have that privilege for me and not to have to spend $500 a room like the guy across the street there. So that's really good. But you can't beat the view, that's for sure, on here.
And speaking of, a lot of people know the America's Cup races. The preliminaries are taking place now, but the real America's Cup races are coming up in September. And I guess you guys here on the O'Brien are going to sell tickets to come watch it from aboard ship?
Yeah, we've been designated as one of the spectator places because the race comes right by us. So you can buy tickets, come aboard the ship, and watch the race as it comes right through. So we've cut back on our trips this year so we can stay dockside and people can watch the races.
And you've been out here for 4th of July. I guess this is quite the place to be on Independence Day too, huh?
I think we had about 750 people for July 4th. They pay to come aboard the ship at night, and then the barge is right in front. You get a fantastic view of the fireworks and everything, and everybody has a great time. We got hot chocolate and cookies and different things. It all comes with the price of the ticket. I think it was like $20 or $25. So It was a great show this year. No fog or anything.
There are a lot of things that impressed me as you took me around the ship to show me things. But I'm curious for you, having been volunteering here for 9 years and all the different things you've worked on, when you look at what tourists can take in here, what there is to see, what are the things that you are most impressed with or that you like to point out to people when they come through?
People love the ship, but they really do love the engine. The triple expansion engine, the 2,500 horsepower engine that supplies the power for the ship is what people love to see. It's pretty impressive. It's an 1890 British patent design. It's very simple. That's why they built these ships with these engines, because it was easy to do. And easy to, it was fast building. A lot of people don't know that the engine room scene for the Titanic was filmed here. So it's the same type of an engine room. It has open connecting rods off the engine, open crankshaft and everything all the way out to the propeller. So people love the whole ship itself. And then forward of the ship, we have the museum, which we run a big video all the time to see how the ships were built and everything. So people like to sit down and watch that for quite a while too. It's pretty impressive. But I would have to say the engine's a big draw for everybody.
Well, one of the things that impressed me as you guided me through this labyrinth that is the Jeremiah O'Brien, to see the complexity of everything and then realize this ship and so many others were being turned out so fast. 6 weeks to build one of these? That's it?
About 6 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks they were launching ships. You know, the story is Henry Kaiser came up with the plan to build these ships. He did them by building them in modules and then welding everything together. And that's why they were able to make them so fast. And then they were made all over the United States in different shipyards. And the West Coast and East Coast had a race to see how fast they could build the ship. And they built one in 4.5 days from scratch to sailing right out in the water, 4.5 days.
If you come and tour this ship and see all the different parts of it and how it all has to come together, I think you'll be blown away by that 4.5 day tally.
A lot of people don't realize once they come on, though, that this is actually a cargo ship. Very few crew members, and these ships carried 80% of all supplies during the war, from what I understand, whether it was food, tanks, ammunition, everything. So you really have to look at it as a ship with everything in the center, and everything fore and aft is all big, giant, empty cargo holds that used to hold a lot of supplies. So once people can comprehend that, you know, then it's a little bit different what they're looking at, 450 feet of storage space, basically.
Well, and that was really crucial to the bigger picture, and the speed with which these ships were produced certainly enabled the Allies to move troops or cargo and supplies all over the place. Another thing that impressed me, Mike, how much of what's on board is original. I mean, there's very little here that has been added on. I mean, maybe there's some things that have been refurbished, but a lot of what you see in every different door is actually original from 70 years ago.
We try to keep everything as historic as we can. These tables are the original ones. They sat on in 1943, the chairs down below us, all the refrigerators and walk-ins. So everything we try to keep as original as possible, you know, unless you have to put some of the modern radar or whatever. But whenever we repair or do anything, like for instance, the coal stove that we use in the galley, that's been there since 43 and still uses coal, and they still cook for us when we're here on Wednesdays, Thursdays, and then steaming weekends. It has to be rebuilt. It's finally burnt down. So we tracked one down in Florida, and now we're in the process of trying to getting it from there to here. It's actually made by Majestic Range that made this same stove, and then possibly we may put that one in, rebuild this other one if it's rebuildable, and then switch them back out. But we try to keep everything as historic as possible.
Right down to machine guns up on the top deck. Those are actually the original guns that the O'Brien would have fired if it were attacked.
Yeah, all the 50 calibers and the aft gun and the bow gun, a 3 and a 5 inch, which again, we have a gun crew here that takes care of those. Everybody sort of has their own little department. But those are all original, and we do have one setup that we use on trips and stuff, which they run on propane, which can actually fire and give you flame and noise and everything like that too. So, you know, and then this is the same as everything else. You know, the radio operating room has people that can still do Morse code because it's set up for that. So, you know, we still have all our individual people that can do what they do.
I guess the biggest question is, and you listen to the show, I know sometimes when you're driving back and forth from Sonora to here, thanks for listening. You know that this show is all about preserving history, and clearly this ship is here to preserve some history. What aspect of the history of this ship and ships like it do you think it's so important to hang on to and to keep alive for future generations?
You know, people seem to forget, especially younger people. They just do, unless they see the movies or watch the movies. And even then, I don't think they really understand what it was like to try to preserve freedom, you know, and have people go out to different countries and try to preserve freedom. So actually getting to see the ship and see it in operation, you can get a pretty good idea what they went through, for sure. You can really get a good idea.
Any memorable reactions you've received aboard ship from people that are seeing it maybe for the first time, or they could be coming from another country to check it out, whatever, but anything that stands out in your mind that has made you feel like, you know what, this is worthwhile, everything that we're doing, because you see what it means to somebody?
We get a lot of tourists from all around the world all the time. If I stayed here all day Saturday, you'd eventually run into one or two or three people that are just so absolutely amazed of the shape the ship is in and the fact that somebody's actually still doing it to keep it here. That's what really makes me feel good, you know. To me, it's just, you know, I'm just doing my regular thing. But when people come by and say, well, I can't believe that you're still keeping us all going and everything looks so great and historical, that makes you feel really good, because you kind of forget about that. Some people are just astounded about how great the ship is, and you can tell they're very proud of what we're doing.
I imagine you guys are proud of each other too, because that's the thing that stands out to me. I mean, when you have up to 200 volunteers, nobody's getting paid to be here. You're all donating your time and your expertise built up through long careers in a lot of cases. Is it inspiring for you to see somebody else who's out here doing what he or she does best?
Absolutely. I do enjoy, you know, the older men that were in the war and have something to do with the military. They can offer quite a bit to us, but I'm also, it's great to find a new volunteer that comes on, a new electrician or a new welder. You know, once you get these guys together, say this is a project we need to do, they all just take off, and it's great. It's a good camaraderie. It's great to get people together like that, you know.
One thing I noticed on the way into the ship, some of the signage features Rosie the Riveter and highlights the role of women in pumping out Liberty ships like the Jeremiah O'Brien.
The women played a huge part. They were the welders. And a lot of these pipes, when you walk around here, you'll see that they're all covered in the jackets, the steam pipes. And if you look really closely there, you're going to see stitching. All those jackets had to be stitched on by somebody. Everybody had a job, whether the women were stitching those on or doing the welding. This was a huge undertaking that women did. And, you know, I've read some of the books. And as a matter of fact, we just had somebody donated from Redwood City, this gentleman's mom, worked on the Liberty ships, and so he donated her little tool chest, her little stool, and a picture of the yard she worked in, too, that we're going to put down in the museum. So the women played a big role back then.
Is there a moral of the story for you in terms of the time you've spent here, what you've gotten out of it, and what it's taught you, what you hope maybe other people get?
I feel like I'm giving something back. I wasn't in the military, so I just feel by working here I'm able to give something back. It's a living, breathing ship, that's for sure. And the part about the volunteers, too, it's actually very interesting to find a way to get volunteers to come from all walks of life, whether they're in the military or whether they're from the private sector or whether they're in a union. It's very difficult to get everybody together on the same page when you're in a volunteer group. But we manage to do that here, and everybody gets along well.
I assume you're always looking for more volunteers. If someone hears this and says, you know what, that sounds like fun, I want to go be a part of it.
Actually, you can go to the website, ssjeremiahobrien.com, and you can check that out. You can also come down to the ship anytime. It's open 7 days a week, and somebody down here will point you the way of what you need to do to join up and be a volunteer. I have found, though, that a lot of the volunteers, I mean, there are a lot of people that are listening to this right now that have time available, that are either an electrician or retired or no steam, and they find out when they come down and check this out, they love it. They're not just hanging around at home or something like that. They can still put their skills to work. They can show other people, you know, because, you know, you need great qualified welders. You know, it's really hard to find good qualified people, and when they bring their skills here, it really makes everything work. The volunteers are from all over, almost very few of them are actually from right here. I mean, I'm from Sonora, we got Santa Rosa, we got Marin, Santa Clara, San Jose. They come from everywhere. You could tell somebody something about something, but unless they're actually here like you today, it's a whole different story. So people really need to come and see it, and then they can realize what it's all about.
Well, I'll testify to that, because I'll tell you, there's a lot more to this ship than meets the eye if you're just looking at it docked here at Pier 45. There is a lot on board to explore and a lot of history to understand. And speaking of that, Mike, with all the research you've done, with the time you've spent, everything you've learned about the ship and the way that it operated during World War II, is there any aspect of that in the stories that you've heard that you look at or listen to and say, yeah, that would be tough. I don't know if I could have handled that. Is there something about what this ship was like in the war that just really amazes you?
From the stories I hear, again, we have a few gentlemen here that were 18 years old on Liberty ships doing the same thing that they're doing now. So like when our ship does run during a steaming weekend or anything and you go down the engine room, it's pretty warm down there. It could be 100 degrees. But we're in San Francisco, so we get cool weather cooling off the engine room. But, you know, the guys say like when you're going through the Panama Canal and it's 120 and hot and humid, that engine room is like 150 degrees. So when you're in the tropics, those type of things I don't think we think of. And you hear the stories about the ships when they're out to sea and going up and down in the waves 40, 50 feet. And these guys tell you they used to have to actually tie themselves into the bed because they would be thrown out. Unless you're there, it's pretty unbelievable. You can only get it by the descriptions they tell you what it was really like. But it doesn't sound like it was a picnic most of the time.
Not in the least. We've heard a lot of those stories here on this show. Hey, thanks a lot to Mike Savino for all his time, the great tour of the SS Jeremiah O'Brien. That big, giant steam-powered engine is running right now, and it's going to be going all weekend at San Francisco's Pier 45. I have quite a few pictures from the O'Brien and the submarine USS Pompanito on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Thanks again to the Wahoo-based submarine veterans for taking me there. And maybe the next time you head up for a Giants game or something, you can take a little detour and explore some World War II history in the city by the bay. That's Hometown Heroes this time around. Next time, we'll mark the 60th anniversary of the end of the Korean War with a passionate and patriotic Navy veteran who served at that time. I'm Paul Loeffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.